This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for being with us for, Talk Louisiana. Signatures of support from First Financial Tax and Accounting Services and from Jerry Lane Chevrolet. Your number is 877-217-5757. Emails to talk at talklouisiana.org. Roman Rybchenko has been with us three previous times since the war in Ukraine began almost 3 months ago. We're 4 days short of the three-month anniversary. But in fewer than 100 days, it's apparent the Ukrainian people are putting up a mighty fight, and Vladimir Putin may not prevail. He may lose. And Roman Rybchenko, when things did not look rosy, was saying exactly that back a few months ago on this show. And yesterday, the United States Senate voted 86-11 for $40 billion in aid to Ukraine to help the fight against Vladimir Putin and his henchmen. The vote included two yes votes from Bill Cassidy and from John Kennedy, Louisiana's senators. In the House, Garrett Graves, a congressman from Baton Rouge, and he voted against it, as did the congressman from Lafayette, Clay Higgins, and Mike Johnson, the congressman from Shreveport. The others voted for the aid. Steve Scalise voted yes. Julia Letlow voted yes. And Troy Carter voted yes. Roman Rybchenko, it is still a perilous time, and of course, thousands of people have died. Buildings have been destroyed. People have been humiliated, raped, tortured. But nonetheless, the Ukrainian people have set an example for all of us about the resolve to stave off the madman from Moscow, Vladimir Putin. Your thoughts?
Well, I would correct the expression madman. I think Mr. Putin is not a madman. He may be acting irrationally right now because he made some decisions before invading Ukraine based on flawed intelligence. But he has no one to blame for it but himself. He is the one that has created this sort of system that rewards the yes man and the lie, the misinformation. And now he's reaping the fruits of his labor. So he's not mad. He's just manipulating the world, the regular people and their views for his own gain, for the gain of the people around him. So this is the way I view it.
Roman Rybchenko, who was a star basketball player at LSU back in the day, and he played for the great Dale Duard Brown. He has been near Kyiv. That's where he was when the war started. And I don't know if you can tell us where your location is now, but I know you in a previous visit said that several women who were with you, that you were protecting, that they had sought refuge elsewhere. How's it looking for you right now? And if you can, where are you, Roman?
So I'm in the deep rear in the middle of the country. It's the Cherkasy region. Cherkasy is a town from where I was born. But I am in that area. I'm not in Cherkasy, but in the Cherkasy region, so to say. The situation is stable. I feel safer now than I did back 2 months ago. I'm sure you can see from the news, the Western news is covering it, that the Russians have been pushed back from many many directions, that the fighting is now concentrated in the east of the country.
Is there an end game here? I don't know that Putin will concede defeat, but is there any way to get him out of there and to perhaps allow him to have some resolution that would result in keeping more people safe than being in harm? Because the longer this goes on, of course, more people are going to be killed, wounded, and it's going to be a catastrophe if this continues on and on and on and on. Is there any resolution to this short of just fight to the bitter end? What do you think?
Well, Jim, I missed the beginning of your question because we got disconnected. Would you mind repeating it?
Yeah, as far as the end game, do you see it coming, or is this going to be a long, tough slog?
It is a difficult situation because in order for the conflict to become what it is today, where Ukraine is, I think I'm prepared to say, is winning, The West and the let's call them the allies, the well-wishers, have created certain conditions for Mr. Putin that gives him very little room for maneuvering. Therefore, basically, he doesn't really have a good off-ramp from this quagmire that he created himself. And so if there was such an off-ramp, I would be more hopeful that this could be over in the near future. Specifically because I do not see such an off-ramp that could satisfy at least minimally whatever agenda he had. And this is essentially just he cannot look bad or weak in the eyes of his constituents and in the eyes of his cronies around him. Because I am sure there's lots of people salivating, just hoping that he's going to lose and he's going to get, at least removed from the power or maybe even killed. And then there will be Russia will be for grabs. So there's plenty of groups that would be happy with that. However, they're not revealing themselves openly right now. So for the lack of this off-ramp, I think this could drag on. And what the projections that I'm hearing, it's going to be at least until the end of summer. And it's going to be that sort of World War One type of warfare, the trench warfare, both sides shelling each other indiscriminately and trying to gain 500 meters and then lose another kilometer going back and forth, which is unfortunate because it doesn't accomplish any goals. Russia does not have anything to gain from this. And
okay, we may have lost Roman again. He is There we go. I'm glad you're with us. But I see that Russia is considering a bill to let over 40s sign up for the military. Roman played for LSU 92 to 96, so I guess you enrolled at LSU when you were about 18. So what are you, about 38 years old, Roman? Is that right?
Well, thank you. Thank you for the compliment. I'm 48 years old today.
48, that's right, because I lost a decade there. Yeah, you're 48. Yeah. Are you having to, when we first started this conversation a few months ago, you commented that you didn't have a weapon yourself. Do you have anything now?
No, I do not, because it's not so easy to procure one in Ukraine. So the only way I'm going to obtain one is once the war is over. I will definitely make it my business to get one. But I, on a related matter, I'm hoping that our government will reconsider the way our military is organized, and we would come up with a system resembling, let's say, the Swiss Army or the Israeli Army, where every male below 60 once a year goes to a mini camp and spends 2 weeks preparing, and everyone knows what their role is if the war started, and everyone has a gun, and everybody is prepared. Mm-hmm. And so as soon as something like this happens, then everyone is ready to go, and you have 1.5 million battle-ready people. I'm totally in support of that sort of system, and most likely we will have to do that, because I do not see that quick resolution. And Russia, it will take some time for Russia and Russian people to start losing their imperialistic attitude and the feeling that all the countries around them should be controlled by them.
877-217-5757. In our remaining time with Roman Rubchenko, 1992 to 96, he came to Baton Rouge, played 4 years for LSU, and went back home. And you are a native Russian, correct?
No, I am not a native Russian. I'm a Ukrainian. But I think this is a very complicated issue, because in the Soviet Union, you did not have a clear way to identify nationality. So, for example, Jewish people identify as Jewish if their mother was Jewish.
Right.
In the Soviet Union, if your father was declaring himself to be Ukrainian and your mother, for example, Russian, like in my case, you would be Ukrainian. But when I'm asking my mom, how do you know that you're Russian? She said, well, my father was Russian. And then, well, but before that, there was no Russians. There were Velikorossi, Malorossi, and Belorossi. So it was like the big Russians, the small, little Russians, and Belorussian. And so I'm, the Soviet history is not to be trusted, but I would not be surprised that Mr. Stalin, when he was wielding his national politics, deporting people from places and shuffling them back and forth in order to avoid the very thing that's happening today. So I think those nationalities were assigned randomly or through some sort of poorly understood process. So, but I am declaring to be a Ukrainian. I have been Ukrainian according to the Soviet rules, and I have been voluntarily Ukrainian since 1991 when Ukraine gained its independence. And I played for the national team, so I am Ukrainian.
You grew up under the Soviet axis, though.
Yes.
And I would imagine by virtue of that, when you were a young person in your formative years, you were indoctrinated with the Soviet mantra that the U.S. is bad, capitalism is wrong, and that they had a better mousetrap. Is that fair?
Yes, that is completely fair. I've faced this since the first memory I have. The typical approach was it's very hierarchical. You have no say. A person is worth nothing.
Hold tight. We're going to pause for 90 seconds, and we will return with the remarkable Roman Rubchenko. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. Roman Rubchenko with us for a few moments, and then we'll be joined by Henry Bushkin, 877-217-5757. Roman is in Ukraine, and some might find it remarkable that he sounds like he's right down the block, because in that country, which is a huge country, there has been immense carnage. I don't think there's any doubt there have been war crimes, and for the most part, the Ukrainians have held off the Russians. Quickly, Roman, the $40 billion that the United States Senate approved yesterday, will this be helpful?
Of course it will be helpful, and besides providing badly needed military and medical and just financial aid, it's also a vote of confidence by such an important ally like the United States that it supports what we're trying to do here. And the Ukrainian people are not doing anything unusual. All we want is we want the right for self-determination. We want the sovereign borders of our country, and we don't want anyone meddling in our business unless we allow them to meddle in our business. So I understand that Russia is a strong a power, a regional power. United States is a global power. But I do not feel very warm towards Russian approaches, the way they treat people, the way they treat freedom of speech, the way they treat, I mean, basically everything. Everything is a lie there, and everything has to be done for the sake of the state. This is something that I've faced during the Soviet Union, and this is why I defected to the United States. I wanted to run away from that. I wanted to be my own man. I wanted to be able to speak my mind. I wanted to be able to make a lot of money if I worked hard, or not make a lot of money if I was lazy and not prepared. So I want self-determination. And this is what Ukrainians want right now.
What about the mantra from, unfortunately, some people in this country, on Fox News in particular, is saying that the president and the people of Ukraine, by extension, that this is a war for Putin to rid Ukraine of Nazism. What do you say to the people who are saying that kind of garbage?
Well, I think they're confusing the two words, nationalism and Nazism. You know, like we are nationalists. Nationalists to say we do have nationalist moods right now because we need to come around some national idea, Ukraine as a separate country, and we need to fight against an aggressor. And so I don't see anything wrong with nationalism here. Nazism is a completely different concept. And I mean, like a really easy rule of thumb is the following. If we were run by Nazis here, I don't think we would give them 1% of the votes during the parliamentary election. None of those parties are represented in the parliament. They're not even serious. At the same time, the government of Israel would not be helping us in our effort against Russia. And there are Israeli medics helping treat our soldiers that are wounded in the battle. And finally, we have a Jewish president, and the previous government had a Jewish prime minister. And so it's impossible in a country that has a Jewish government officials to be classified as Nazis, because, I mean, Nazis war against the Jews, and they exterminated 6 million of them.
Bill downtown, please be brief. You're on with Roman Rubchenko.
Yeah, I've often wondered what would happen in this country if we were invaded and attacked by, another military power, not like this, stuff about the southern border. I'm talking about a real invasion. You've lived here in the U.S. How do you think we would react? I'm really concerned about that.
Well, I think, at least based on my experience living in Louisiana and Texas, that American people, despite the fact that you've been sort of relaxed because of such a peaceful time for such a long time, you would come together very quickly. I can see that Americans are huge patriots, and you do have guns, unlike us. So I'm sure there's going to be a bunch of militias helping out the American army as well. So I'm confident that the United States would have responded, the people of the United States would have responded just the way Ukrainians did.
Final caller for Roman Rybchenko, David in Atlanta. Please be brief. Hi, David.
I'd like to salute and praise the brave and courageous people of Ukraine and wish them well. Paul Krugman writes in his column today, Ukraine is essentially winning the war. In Russia, it's not so much that the Russian economy is failing, not so much that they can't export their assets, but they can't buy the replacement military equipment to fight the war.
All right, Roman, is that accurate based on what you know?
Yes. Yes, that is accurate, because most of the equipment that was produced in Russia, they were produced with the parts sold to them by Western companies. So cessation of that trade is a very effective tool. Another effective tool is stop buying their oil, which Europeans are sort of slow at making that decision, and then eventually stop buying their gas, which I understand takes some more time because of the structural problems.
All right, a listener asked about Mariupol quickly. That does not look like it's going well. Your thoughts?
Well, Mariupol is going to be, in the future, once we actually see the full picture, it's going to be one of the worst chapters of this war, because the city was shelled indiscriminately. There's estimates that there were about 20 to 25,000 people perished in that city, but it's impossible to know right now for sure. Our brave soldiers that kept defending the city until a couple of days ago did a tremendous service to their country, because they tied up a bunch of Russian forces and then prevented them from engaging in different areas of the front of the fighting line. So those guys are true heroes, and I cannot imagine like what kind of bravery does it take to actually act that way. However, it was a humanitarian catastrophe. The city is completely destroyed, and I don't know what the future holds, because Russians have occupied it, and our defenders have been taken prisoners voluntarily, but basically they're trying to evacuate them and save their lives.
Roman, we'll be calling again next time. I'll try to get, and I think you'll be game, to your coach Dale Brown to come on with you. But
yes.
Are there people listening who can help? Is there any way to assist your cause?
Well, as I said before, the website is ukraine.org, and Ukraine is spelled as Ukraine. We are fundraising right now for the families of fallen soldiers, and we're contemplating also spending some money on helping them rehabilitate, because there's going to be a lot of injured soldiers and a lot of soldiers that would require psychological help dealing with PTSD and such.
Thank you, Roman. Always a pleasure. Brave man, and very gallant in his comments. Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Jim. I appreciate it.
And now we segue to a story that has less drama, but was part of the American fabric for three decades, Johnny Carson. He's now been off the air as long as he was on, and the guy who was with him for 18 of those years, described as his best friend, the bombastic Bushkin. Henry Bushkin, his lawyer and biographer, is with us to remember Johnny Carson, who called it a career on May 22, 1992, his final Tonight Show. Many thought he would come back. After all, Carson was, at that time, only 66 years old. By today's standards, when we look at some of the political icons, he was a young man, but he never came back. Henry Bushkin, good morning, sir.
Good morning, Jim. Good to be with you.
Well, it's a pleasure, and Henry wrote the book, Johnny Carson, and soon there will be Good to be King, and he was with us not so long ago. He has, Henry, unearthed many great nuggets of Carson's earlier years, including some time in New Orleans and in Jackson, Mississippi, where he attended Millsaps College, and he went off and fought in World War II, and Johnny Carson was a boxer. In fact, he may have had CTE as a result of his 10 boxing matches. But Henry Bushkin, he was not only the greatest television star in the history of the medium, he was a complex man, no doubt about that. But he had these parts of his life that he kept secret in public view. Really fascinating stuff.
Yeah, and it was stuff that basically I learned after my first book was published, because so many people got in touch with me, particularly classmates of his from Millsaps College who are in Jackson, Mississippi. Actually, one of them died last month, a good friend of Carson's named Billy Mann, who was...
We're going to pick up, and we'll hear the Billy Mann story and much more from Henry Bushkin, biographer of his friend, Johnny Carson. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. May 22nd, 1992, 30 years ago, Robin Williams and Bette Midler were the final guests on Johnny Carson's Last Tonight Show. And he was on that show, Johnny Carson was, from 1962 to 1992. He succeeded Jack Parr, who was a big success, and Parr succeeded Steve Allen, who was a success. But nobody had the staying power, the ratings, and the panache is Mr. Carson, and he was a complex individual. His friend, lawyer, biographer, they parted on bad terms, but it's apparent that Henry Bushkin, who has told the good and the bad about Johnny Carson, reveres the man, and in Good to Be King, which is coming soon, Johnny Carson is revealed as a consummate split personality on television and in performances. He came off as the quintessential boy next door with a wicked sense of humor, an instinct for humor that few had, but he was also, surprisingly, a good athlete and a deft illusionist. He was tough. He won 10 boxing matches without defeat as a middleweight serving aboard the USS Battleship Pennsylvania during World War II, and he was lifting weights before anyone heard of Arnold Schwarzenegger, and he loved a challenge. The tougher, the better. On air, he even boxed with Muhammad Ali, so... Henry Bushkin has captured Johnny Carson in all his glory, and his life was framed by his formative years, a youth that was not idyllic in Nebraska, and then he goes off to Mississippi, and really a lot of the Carson stories about his interests and his personality, they emanate from those early years in Jackson, Mississippi. You were telling us about this guy you found who was still alive, who was an associate of Carson at Millsaps College. Tell us more, Henry Bushkin.
Hey, well, actually, his name was Billy Mann, and he died last month. And at his funeral, they talked a great deal about the fact that he was Johnny's roommate at Millsaps. And for my new book, he was a great source of information, as well as another chap, also 96 years old, who lives in Jackson, who goes to a furniture store every day that he runs. His name is Don Kazary. And these two gave me great insights about Millsaps, about Jackson, Mississippi in 1943 and 1944. And unfortunately, when I knew Johnny, I knew none of this stuff. None of this information was available to me in 1970. And it's now 2022, and we have enormous resources to find information. And that's what I found so interesting about writing this new book, about how dynamic this guy was, this guy Johnny Carson, in his formative years. He was completely different than he was after 1970. Before 1970, he was basically a guy you'd like to hang out with. Okay, the guy who could command the room and had no real dark side at the time. He was just a rising radio and television star starting in 1949.
What happened in 1970?
Well, I met him in 1970, and he was already a formed human being. It was the years between 1943 and 1969 that that made him a gigantic star, and it was after 1970 when I got involved that his personality was already formed, his habits were already formed, his possible CTE problems were were apparent, headaches, mood swings, personality issues, all things that I attribute to 1945 when he was boxing on the USS Pennsylvania while in Guam.
Johnny Carson, he would be 96 years old, October 23, 1925 to January 23, 2005. He just missed making 80. He led a full life like many of his generation. He smoked, he drank. Unlike many, though, he exercised until practically the day he died. Avid tennis player. And as we used to see, he looked very good in a suit. He had a good physique. He certainly cared about his appearance, which is a big part of television. And his life was framed by those formative years. Now, you noted that he was just a downright brilliant guy, that he could have made money perhaps even more than he did if he had been a professional gambler.
For the record, there's a series coming out that will be on the air next year. It's written by David Milch and showrunning by Jay Roach, both two well-known figures in Hollywood. And it starts out in 1970 with Johnny in a card game. But actually, his formative years in 1943 and 1944 and 45, he was a pretty good card player at the time. And yeah, he could have been a brilliant gambler if that was the route he chose to take.
A listener asked, you mentioned the USS Pennsylvania. Were there any close calls in World War II, or did he have a pretty easy time of it?
I don't think he had an easy time. He joined the battleship Pennsylvania the day it was torpedoed.
Wow!
And his first task as the youngest officer on board the ship was to remove the 20 dead sailors in the compartment that the torpedo hit. He was in charge of removing those sailors, so it wasn't an easy or pleasant task, obviously.
Why do you think he did not talk about those years? You were his closest friend.
I wish I knew. I wish I knew now what I knew then. Look, in 1970, we had the Encyclopedia Britannica, okay, and some newspaper articles and maybe magazine articles. That's what we had. So when I started representing Johnny Carson, to me, he was a major star. I was a young lawyer. I was nervous all the time that I was not going to be able to do what he needed me to do. But in reality, I had no idea about his background. I had no idea about the battleship Pennsylvania. I had no idea that he pitched to Mickey Mantle in Yankee Stadium with Yogi Berra catching. Okay, in 1963, for baseball fans, I mean, how amazing is that to pitch to Mickey Mantle in Yankee Stadium in 1963? I mean, I grew up five blocks from Yankee Stadium. Mickey Mantle was my hero. And I wish I had known that stuff.
Yeah. Well, Carson, on occasion, when he would have Pete Fountain or Al Hurd on, he would note his affinity for New Orleans, and he wasn't just blowing smoke. He knew that city pretty well. You write in this book that will soon be coming, It's Good to Be King, that he used to come to New Orleans when he was Jackson, Mississippi. He'd stay at the Monteleone. He'd have dinner at Antoine's and the Commander's Palace. You note also that the hotel in those days, $12 for two nights, $12 for two nights at the Monteleone. And Carson, by the way, that was big money in those days. But he was this young guy, still a teenager, and he had over $400 with him when he came to New Orleans, didn't he?
Well, he had over $400 when he showed up at Millsaps. And then one of the great things about Jackson geographically, it's not a long drive to New Orleans or to Memphis or to Baton Rouge for that matter.
No.
And so I thought it kind of interesting that he took a girlfriend with him for a weekend, and the entire weekend cost him about $30 or $35, including meals at Commander's Palace and Antoine's.
Well, I mentioned his last show, and that's why we're talking. And of course, we like to bring Henry on at least once or twice a year. But in these stories about people who grew up watching Johnny Carson, I'm sure are causing some to smile. But his last show was 30 years ago, May 22nd, 1992. People thought he would be back, but he really never did another audio interview after that, one print interview that I'm aware of. But here's how he sounded in the farewell in beautiful downtown Burbank,
May 22, 1992.
And so it has come to this. I'm one of the lucky people in the world. I found something I always wanted to do, and I have enjoyed every single minute of it. I want to thank the gentleman who shared this stage with me for 30 years, Mr. Ed McMahon, Mr. Doc Severinsen, and you people watching. I can only tell you that it has been an honor and a privilege to come into your homes all these years and entertain you. And I hope when I find something that I want to do and I think you will like and come back, that you'll be as gracious inviting me into your home as you have been. I bid you a very heartfelt good night.
That was Johnny Carson, May 22, 1992, gone but not forgotten. But it is difficult for those of us who grew up with him, and he was a fixture in American homes for many decades, that he's been gone now as long as he was on as far as television. And the other day, the New York Times, 2 days, had front page stories about Tucker Carlson and his appeal with 3.6 million nightly viewers. Now, Johnny Carson, how many viewers, Henry, did he have on a good night when he was hosting The Tonight Show?
Well, his average was 14 or 15 million people a night. And interestingly enough, in 1969... one show that you had.
I know. Let's talk about that show. It is an amazing story from Henry Bushkin, and we'll return right after this. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. A few more minutes with Henry Bushkin, lawyer, friend, confidant to Johnny Carson. When Carson got married for the fourth and last time, Henry went with Carson, I think, on his honeymoon. He knew him well, and they parted less than amicably, but it's apparent from Henry that even though he's told some stories that Johnny Carson probably wishes he hadn't, that on the whole, you really loved the guy, didn't you?
Well, I look at it this way. Tragedy, perhaps, in 1988, and 30 years later, comedy and great reflection of how things are and were. So, yeah, I mean, it was for me, it was traumatic at the time, but 30 years later, I have great affection for him, as I always did.
You were mentioning 1969, I think his highest rated show ever. And now, by the way, when you said 15 million viewers a night on the average, this is from 11:30 to 1 Eastern time, in a time when the country was about half the size that it is now as far as people. So he was the king. But 1969, my God, he probably had 50 million people watching. What happened that night?
Well, he had an audience that night that was greater than the Super Bowl and the Academy Awards combined, okay, that evening. And it was Tiny Tim getting married on his show. That was the event. And I think that night he had like 57 or 58 million viewers, which was remarkable. And what I find remarkable today as it relates to my book, so many people say, who remembers Johnny Carson? I mean, is he still relevant? Is it important to tell anything about a guy that very few people remember? And my response is, I think there are still 40 million people alive that used to watch Johnny every night. But the young millennials and younger people say, Johnny Carson, who is he? I mean, if you mention Bob Hope to some people, they'll say, well, there's an airport named after him in Orange County. Jack Benny, they have no idea who Jack Benny was. So I think your show and my book and this series coming out, we're trying to keep Carson relevant.
All right. Well, we've got a gentleman who's
pop culture.
Been waiting for a little while. We want to slide in one caller, Barry in Mid-City. Barry, I'm sorry we kept you on hold for a while, but you're on with Henry Bushkin. Hi, sir.
Hey, good morning. Good morning, Henry. How about Karnak? Can you say a few words about Karnak? I just love that routine with the big head on him.
Well, yeah, Karnak was actually a derivative of what Steve Allen created years earlier called The Answer Man. So Karnak, although brilliant, was really a derivation of what Steve Allen started maybe 8 or 10 years earlier. But as a bit, it was one of the prime funniest bits that people remember from The Tonight Show.
Thank you, Henry Bushkin. We'll be in touch again soon. It's good that you're keeping the flame alive, and the book, when it appears, Good to Be King, it's bound to be a provocative book, as was his last one. And this time, it's about a time in the life of one Johnny Carson that most people don't know about. So new information, and that's always pleasurable, about a figure who dominated the small screen like nobody before or since. Henry, thanks.
Thank you. Thank you, Jim. Appreciate it.
We're joined in studio in our home stretch by Paul Braun, the Capital Access reporter for WRKF and WWNO. And before we get to Paul, I do want to note that tonight Tim Muffett returns for one last time, the longtime conductor of the Baton Rouge Symphony, who's in in Lansing, Michigan. He is conducting his final concert as the symphony's maestro. He had a 23-year career and is a big part of our community. Exceptional man. Talk about looking good in a suit. Manuel Martinez made him look well, and Tim had the physique to do it. But tonight, 7:30, River Center Performing Arts, Tim Muffett with Beethoven's Ninth. So if you can make it, be good to say farewell to one Tim Muffett. And in studio is Paul Braun, and he is covering the Capitol. And yesterday, the state legislature gave the final approval to a $39 billion spending plan. The governor was on his radio show in this studio a few days ago, and he didn't sound all that perturbed about the budget overall, but he didn't get everything he wanted, Paul.
No, he didn't. Governor Edwards started out this budget process with two big pitches, and the big one from off the top was getting $500 million for a down payment on a new Mississippi River Bridge in the Baton Rouge area, something that's been long sought by folks in our listening area, I think. And then another one was more pay for teachers. And he got part of both of those things. But Edwards initially proposed $1,500 for teachers at K-12 public schools, $750 for school support staff. And that's ultimately what he got. But with that initial pitch, he said, if there's more money available, I would like $2,000 for teachers, $1,000 for support staff. And the legislature fell short of both of those marks. They're keeping in mind, maybe some changing economic circumstances in the next year or two, and also the loss of some state revenue coming up in 2025 when a 0.45-cent sales tax rolls off the books. Yeah, there was a lot of discussion about that budget, and really it's all passed very quickly. Legislative leaders have run a really tight ship in budget negotiations this year in hopes of getting things done early, giving themselves maybe the opportunity to override some line item vetoes, something that hasn't been a part of the budget process really in recent memory and probably ever in Louisiana, given the amount of influence that governors traditionally have had. But the legislature is on an independent streak, and we'll see how that all factors in the home stretch of this session.
All right. Zach at LSU asks if raises for faculty are included for college professors, and I think that's 3%.
3%, right. And there was a bit of a shift in that from the version that passed the House had faculty raises at 5%. One of the big differences in the Senate version of the budget, which is ultimately what passed yesterday, had 3% raises for faculty and staff. And those are to be assessed and doled out at the discretion of the universities themselves, depending on who they think is worthy of it. So it may be more or less for some faculty members, depending on what their administration thinks. But it was a 3% increase to the amount that the state pays for salaries at those institutions.
And this revelation that House Speaker Clay Schexnider was involved in some interesting expenditures involving his stepsons has now taken a new wrinkle. Jay Darden, the Commissioner of Administration, is accusing the House Speaker of cutting Darden's budget by $3.3 million because the Division of Administration refused to pay Schexnider's stepsons for renovating two apartments at the Pentagon Barracks. So this is an interesting wrinkle.
It really is. And we've seen sort of little breadcrumbs for this particular story that's been reported excellently by Sam Carlin and Tyler Bridges, just came out in the last couple of days, and now we've got follow-ups. But, you know, the speaker has been pushing to move the authority over the Pentagon Barracks, the whole Capitol complex, which includes the Capitol itself, the Pentagon Barracks, and some other outbuildings, from the Division of Administration to the Office of the Lieutenant Governor, which he's planning on running for Lieutenant Governor. He's privately said in 2023, that's something he hopes to do. And so this tug of war over who controls these buildings has been simmering for a long time. And you would stand to reason that this dispute over the particular remodeling of his own apartment in that complex is factored into it. But we heard some discussions about this on the House floor and some, yeah, still some wrangling over who mm-hmm. will control these buildings and if it might be Schexnider more directly in the future.
And the transports bill looks like it's headed for the governor's desk. It's passed both houses by veto-proof margins. The governor was a little cagey on his show 2 days ago, but based on what he did last year, it wouldn't be a surprise if he vetoed this. And then what?
And then what is a good question. Yeah, I mean, the governor, I think, was very cagey in his response to some questions you had for him on Wednesday. And I think part of that might be he saw what happened. He doesn't usually indicate he's going to veto something early. He did that last year with this particular piece of legislation. And we saw the first veto override session in 30 years to take that on. They failed. But this year, you know, with the door open, there was one successful override of the redistricting proposals back in March. And you know, legislative leaders have said that they kicked the door open on veto overrides, and a couple of Democrats are really all they need, a couple of independents, all that they would need to override this in the House. They've got the votes they need in the Senate, and those veto-proof majorities might stick this time.
And if he uses his line item veto, as governors almost always do, then lawmakers now, they have the capacity to fight back.
They do, and the big thing is they got it done in time that they wouldn't have to reconvene in July to have a special veto session for that purpose. They'll still be here when Edwards issues his line item vetoes, which logistically makes it a lot easier for them to pull off one of these veto overrides. In theory, politically, it may be a lot trickier because, you know, the line item vetoes are typically aimed at projects limited in scope, limited mm-hmm. in the area they affect, usually at in the districts of folks he's trying to get some political retribution against. So it may be a little trickier to pull that off.
Well, thank you, Paul Braun. We'll hear from Paul again next week. Signature support from First Financial Tax and Accounting Services and from Jerry Lane Chevrolet. Stay safe and stay tuned.